Welcome to the Matthew Moran Podcast. Here you'll discover a series of in-depth conversations with some of the world's leading nature photographers, filmmakers, conservationists, editors, writers, and publishers. Gain unique insights into the lives of industry experts and the unsung heroes, their personal stories, creative processes, and how they make their passion sustainable. We also explore the role photography and filmmaking play in engaging audiences around the world about the global challenges facing wildlife. And despite the often grim statistics, we focus on solutions and discuss what each of us can do to contribute to conservation efforts. I'm incredibly grateful to all my guests who generously give up their time to share their wisdom, and I'm really excited to bring these inspiring conversations to you. This week, my guest is Aaron Jacoski. Aaron is a photojournalist and filmmaker who focuses on human-animal conflict. And for over 15 years, he has traveled the world, documenting the intricate connections between humans and wildlife. His work explores topics such as the illegal wildlife and pet trade, deforestation, marine conservation, and wildlife tourism. His images have been featured in numerous international publications and have earned recognition in major global photography competitions. I'm not feeling 100%, so you don't really want to be hearing my voice for too long. We're going to get straight to it. But first, a massive thank you to all those who signed up to the Patreon this year. Your donations have helped keep this podcast alive, and I am so, so grateful. So if you don't already and you'd like to support, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/Matthew Moran Photography. Without further ado, here's Aaron. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been long overdue. We've been sort of following each other for a while now, and Marcus, one of the big fans of this podcast, been cheerleading you to get on. I hope you haven't taken it personally that you haven't come on until now.
I think all those subtle hints that I was leaving you on your Instagram timeline. Oh, you know, I would be free if you ever wanted to chat shamelessly. But now I'm here. So
you're here.
Obviously, it obviously works, persevering.
And it's all merit, of course.
And a healthy dose of begging.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? Think about when I first started these, and I don't know, I should look back and maybe congratulate myself. I've got really good people on this podcast, including yourself. And it's been so much fun over the last few days, and fascinating, and also really daunting and really sad, looking through a lot of your work. But we are optimistic, upbeat people. We're going to talk positivity as well about your work and on this podcast. Yeah.
That's going to be a very quick podcast
then. Oh my goodness. So you're based in Manila. We're speaking, 8 hours apart now. And just how did you end up there, by the way? Because you're are you from Buckinghamshire?
No, I'm from Leamington Spa in the middle of England. Okay. How did I end up in Manila? Well, as sort of all good stories start, where of course a lady was involved. So my wife has a TV show in Manila. So we met like a few years ago. And because my work is kind of based all over the place and she has to be here. So I ended up coming to Manila. I like it. It's nice enough. We're also building a house out on one of the islands, because Manila is ultimately, it's a big city, and I'm not super keen on all the kind of noise and chaos. It's a nice place.
And I can imagine it's a great hub for, a lot of your work. Well, I mean, we talk about where you've been. A lot of it is around the world, but a lot of it is in Southeast Asia. It's probably quite a good hub for that.
Correct. Yeah. It's so easy to jump on a flight and to travel around Southeast Asia. You know, it's very cheap. It's very quick. Like you say, a lot of the stories that I've been covering around the exotic pet trade or wildlife trade or, wet markets, there are so many stories to cover here. So I think I've been in Southeast Asia now for maybe 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
And then before then I was in Africa for 8 years.
Yeah. Wow, amazing. And it's quite funny, actually. I was just thinking about your wife, because I don't know if you know this, but when you Google you, there's Aaron Jacoski comes up, but probably the second or third one down, it says Aaron Jacoski wife. Yeah, so enough people are looking up you. But typing in your wife's name.
My wife is, well, she's been on TV now for like 20 years in the Philippines. So she's quite well known here. When I first met her and I came for a date in the Philippines and like people were stopping her on the street, I was like, are you famous? This is weird. Am I like dating a celebrity here? And she's wonderful.
That's funny. That's brilliant. Actually, my daughter, who's six, is going through that phase of, you know, understanding fame and famous people. You know, she's quite into Taylor Swift, for example. And earlier this year, I had two shows on Springwatch. And so, you know, that was quite a big deal. And she was telling her friends at school and, oh, yeah, my dad's going to be on TV. And then she came back one day and she's just said, Daddy, are you famous? I was like, oh, it's so sweet, you know. I was like, well, maybe in my tiny little world, you know, of nature photography, there might be a few people who know who I am, but like, you know, that's
yeah. And the world of conservation photography, the 75 people who are also involved might have heard of me at some point.
Exactly. But yeah, look, you mentioned Africa and you know, it would be good to go back and talk about that journey, because reading the introduction in one of your books, Animosity, was your story of this sort of dream of going out to Africa and just growing up on the David Attenborough documentaries, like myself and so many others who have got into this industry have done. You know, I thought your one was quite powerful, sort of talking about I want to go and be part of that. And, you know, the Serengeti, the migrations, you know, all the megafauna. And it wasn't long before you quickly realized that that bubble was burst. Is that kind of fair to say? Or did you have some good moments of pure wildlife photography before you dived into the dark stuff?
Yeah. Like you were saying, I mean, we grew up with David Attenborough and we grew up with this vision of the wilderness being this kind of utopian dream where everything is perfect and wildlife is in abundance and, you know, the natural world is thriving. Whereas actually when you get out and you go up into the field, you see that things aren't quite as they seem on those David Attenborough documentaries. So it was actually very quickly after arriving into Africa all those years ago, maybe like 16 years ago, that I started investigating other stories. And yeah, the original dream was to go out there and to make films about the beauty of the natural world. And then everywhere you turn, you see all of the problems. So I started initially working on a documentary about shark finning. I met some British filmmakers in Mozambique and I spent a couple of years just kind of taking everything in because it was all so foreign to me. I was this kid who had owned a modeling agency in London just, you know, a few months before. And then there I was like living in shark fishing communities in the middle of Mozambique. I knew nothing. I knew nothing about how to use a camera. I knew nothing about the world, about some of the complexities of conservation. And I was just like a sponge for years, just soaking everything in. And it was some of the happiest, most fulfilling period of my life, for sure. So from there, I started to then kind of travel with my camera. And I learned it's not just sharks that are being killed for their fins, but it's tortoises that are being exported for the exotic pet trade. It's seals that are being clubbed to death for their fur. It's rhinos being killed for their horns. I mean, there's just so many stories. And I just found all of these individual stories so complex and so multifaceted. And the imagery for me was just much richer. It's much more interesting to go out rather than shooting a picture of a shark underwater swimming around, to actually show a shot of a fisherman taking a shark's fins off in a shark finning camp in Mozambique. And I think the images, I think they're much more important as well. For me now, it almost feels a bit kind of narcissistic to go out there with a camera and just be documenting things for the sake of, you know, showing a great photo of an animal living in its natural habitat. Look at me, what a great photographer I am. Look at this great shot. Why not actually use our skills to broadcast some of these important stories?
Yeah. And that I think is interesting. And, you know, one of the thoughts I had was, you know, you were out there in green, you know, expecting you know, a Lion King scenario, and then what you got was death and horror, but you didn't run, you know, 100 miles from that, which, you know, and I know that that kind of style of photography is not for everyone. You know, I dipped my toe into it, photographing the hunt, and, you know, that the fox hunt, you know, issue that we have here in the UK. And it was sinister, you know, it's a sinister world to be in and around. And it just wasn't for me. You know, I found my activism, you know, in other ways, in talking to people. You know, my speciality is local, but, you know, what was it that kind of kept you going? I mean, maybe a two-pronged question, a slightly disconnected, but I'm also interested in that journey from running a modeling agency, just, you know, to kind of giving that up, to then become, you know, to try and make it as a wildlife photographer, which is an industry notorious for not being a great living and, you know, very difficult to get finance.
I think it was just when I had the business in the UK, and I felt unhappy, and I wasn't enjoying my life working in the modeling world. It just wasn't for me. But it was good fun. It was something I did in my mid-20s. And then I just kind of had this burning desire to go out there, and I would dream of leaving it all behind and selling up and just heading out into the wilderness. That was my idea of heaven. Like, I just felt so many burdens, like at such a young age, you know, with tax returns and running a business and having people that you were responsible for. And, you know, a house and a mortgage and all of those things. And I just desperately wanted to be rid of like everything and just go out. It was very idealistic and a bit of a sort of crazy idea. And I said to my friends and family that I was going to get rid of my business and go off and learn to be a wildlife filmmaker. And they said, you'll be back in a week. And that was when I was like, right, okay, I'm going to prove those guys wrong. So then I went off and I started just to go backpacking around Southeast Asia, as you do. There's me, you know, thinking that I'm on this great crusade and I'm just, you know, getting drunk around Southeast Asia and learning to dive and having a great time. There was nothing kind of heroic about it whatsoever. But at the same time, I was also learning all the time, and I was learning about diving and conservation and some of the threats that marine life is facing. So then it was about kind of taking that skill set to the next level as well. I also just found it was just learning every day. That was so nice. We lived quite prescribed life where, I don't know, I think being like a product of a middle-class family where you go and you go to school and you do your secondary education and then you go to university and you do something almost business related. And then you go to London and then you get a job in a corporate world. And it was the first time in my life that I actually had this kind of free will. And I was going off and just exploring and learning. And it was just fascinating. But it was, it was also very scary at the same time. And I was so out of my depth when I look back. And I also wish that I had learned a lot more about photography rather than just saying, I don't need to go out and do a course, and maybe being a little bit more humble and being like, okay, let's go and let's learn about at least some of the basics rather than just like picking a camera up and thinking that you can do it.
Yeah.
Because when I look back now at a lot of these shoots that I was involved in, I had this amazing opportunity.
Sure.
To get these incredible visuals. And I just stuffed up one shot after another because I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
So actually,
it's the flip side, that, isn't it, of being like gregarious and just going out there and doing it, which is, there's loads of, you know, merit and opportunity in having that boldness and maybe cockiness. But then, yeah, you're right. The other side is like, well, let's learn some structure here. I mean, you know what, Aaron, it's never too late. I did Missouri Photo Workshop at 46 and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I haven't done more of this kind of professional development. It's just so good.
Yeah. And that's the great thing about photography is you are constantly learning, and you can learn so much from people who are in different fields within photography. I went just a year ago and I said to this fashion photographer, I was like, please just let me be your assistant for a couple of days. Like, I'd really just love to learn some different techniques from you. And I picked up so much that could then be applied to environmental photography. So yeah, I think now maybe a little bit more humble rather than that sort of brash arrogance of just being like, the best way of learning is doing. No, the best way of learning is often asking people and watching tutorials and reading books. Like the photography, despite what some people might say, is really a very, very difficult art form, although digital photography has made things so much easier.
Yes. But,
crikey, never stop learning.
No. And also
get in touch with me and they say, like, can I have some tips about how to get into photography and how to get into this world? And that's what I always say is never stop learning.
Mm.
Keep watching, keep reading, keep asking questions of people that you admire. Because there's the industry is changing day by day.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. That's the other beauty of our industry is in the change is not just technological, but also styles, you know, what, you know, editors want, you know, and obviously moving into the film world, the capability that we all have with mirrorless cameras to shoot 4K video, it's endless, you know, and I myself have moved much more into that world of video. Stills commissions for me are just something of the past, and you know, I enjoy it. I mean, I really enjoy doing both, but you know, my heart's always going to be as a stills photographer. I still feel like a kid that was so excited about photography when I was in the darkroom and watched that first print come up, and that's magic. But look where we've come from since then, and actually that again, you know, I think if you have that humbleness now that maybe you didn't have when you were 25, then that's brilliant, because it's going to change even more. And, you know, maybe we will get into the whole AI thing. But yeah, that's a whole other world that we need to pay attention to and, you know, be careful with as well.
Yeah. I mean, I just got the new Canon, the R5 II, and you look at it and you're like, how did people miss any shots with it? Like, the technology is so good. And they've integrated AI into it now as well. I mean, it's just remarkable how things have moved forward in terms of technology. But wow, what a piece of kit.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I know. And just so quick as well. I mean, I think, well, interesting. I was looking at through your Animosity book, and that was published in 2020, right?
Yeah. So
that's frightening, isn't it? That's already over 4 years ago. And, you know, since then, you know, we've got all this incredible noise reduction software, you know, even with our Fox book that's 2 years old, I would go back and reprocess all of those and use that noise reduction software. I mean, it's just incredible.
And also just how much we develop as photographers. I now can't even look at my book because I look at the images like, those are a heap of crap, half of them. And please buy Animosity on Amazon.
Yes, yeah,
today.
Yeah. Great salesman. we'll put the links up.
I mean, the stories are still good, but a lot of, and the image processing, it's so good. I was watching a tutorial the other day, and they said, just go through your Instagram feed and go right to the bottom of it and then go to the top today just to see how much that you have developed as a photographer, and give yourself a pat on the back.
Yeah. My God, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, I don't know whether I should admit this like to the public. I've started using the auto button in Lightroom, and it's so good. Like, I was just like, oh my God, you know, you could just spend hours on all of these sliders, just like hit auto, boom, done. I mean, I don't know about you. I really don't enjoy spending loads of time in front of a computer anyway.
It's always a great starting point, the auto button.
Yeah.
For sure. It's a great, and the capabilities with the new Lightroom and the masking is ridiculous. How you can now mask an entire person and then it will pick out their lips and their eyebrows and their eyes and their nose. And then you have different masks for each of them. I mean, the technology is incredible.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Let's jump forward to Dethroned. We can go back and forward a little bit, but you know, this is really fresh in my mind. I've watched the film. It's your second film that I've watched, but again, going through your website, and you've been involved in over 100 short form and long form documentaries.
Yeah.
That's quite a lot of work, Aaron.
Correct. Yeah, it is a lot of work. And especially because my team and I are involved in every stage of the process, from the fundraising, the pre-production, to the all of the post-production. But that's the part that I love about filmmaking. I love seeing your film come to fruition after many years of trying to raise funds and all of you working for free, and then seeing every project that we do ends up snowballing into something much bigger. Like Dethrone was meant to be a 15-minute documentary for CITES on some of the threats facing big cats. And now it's an hour and 20 minutes. There's actually two cuts of it. There's a director's cut and there's a cut for TV. But they all end up taking on a life of their own. And I'm really lucky because I work with a fantastic team. I have a brilliant director that I work with called Will Foster Grande. We've been working together now for like 10, 12 years.
Brilliant.
He is definitely the brains of the operation. And then I have a fantastic editor as well called Damien. And I'm just so lucky to be able to work with these guys who are just fantastic storytellers. I'm responsible more for like the fundraising, the dealing with the clients, often, finding great stories as well. Because traveling so much and working on assignments, we're always great stories kind of fall on my lap.
Yeah. And then I guess it's building relationships, isn't it, with connected people that can get you access, because access is key, isn't it, to everything, especially with what you do.
Exactly. Yeah. And I love that part of it. I love building relationships and forming friendships. I've met so many incredible people around the world. And then whereas my other team members, they're more kind of introverts and they're great at the creative side. So everyone has their own roles. And when you meet really good people in this industry, you often end up working together for, decades. Yeah.
And it's the other nice thing about filmmaking is that you are, like you say, a team, and it's great if you have those relationships, whereas stills photography, we tend to be a lot more isolated and, because we're just doing one thing by ourselves. So yeah, wearing both hats, it certainly comes across in your work, in all of the photo projects that you've done. I mean, I know that you're often working in collaboration with NGOs, but, when you're out in the field, maybe there's an assumption that you're, doing that work by yourself.
Yeah. A lot of the time, I go on assignment completely on my own, and that's not always ideal. It's often much better to be part of a team, I think, for numerous reasons. And first of all, is you keep each other positive. You build each other up, so you can, especially working on some of the darker or more dangerous missions, that's really, really important. Sometimes when I work on projects on my own and you're doing something that is quite dangerous, you can end up going into some very funny, dark places. So now, as much as possible, I always try and at least have like a work alongside a videographer or an assistant or someone who can come along on board.
And so let's talk a little bit about Dethrone, because what was interesting for me is I watched that film and then I went back and watched Eyes of the Orangutan, and you say that what's nice is that you can see a style between the two films and kind of a similar format in this sort of investigative process that you're doing, and also some pretty hairy stuff and some pretty tricky situations you get yourself into. But you feel free to jump back between both, but tell us a bit about how the plan for this film was to be 15 minutes. And why was that? And then how did it evolve into this, brilliant piece, which by the way, it's so beautifully shot as well. Just some of the scenes are, and again, for a difficult subject, you haven't pulled any punches at all.
Thank you. Yeah. Like I say, Will is just he's a brilliant director and he's really an artist. So every single shot, in the same way that we will compose a photograph and think about every single photograph very carefully, he does that with every single shot in
that was so evident. Yeah.
1 hour, 20 minute film. So huge respect for what he's managed to pull off here. Wait, what was the question again?
It was It was the original idea for this film, Dethroned, was a 15-minute CITES thing.
That's right. Okay. So with films, sometimes they can be passion projects and they're ideas that you come across on your own and then you pitch them out to people and you try and raise the funds. And then sometimes they fall on your lap, like I said earlier. And this was actually with Four Paws, who approached me and said, look, are you interested in making a short documentary about all the big cats and all the threats they face? Which is really a very difficult brief. Where do you even begin to start with that? So We took that and we then approached Terramata, who are a production company on Eyes of the Orangutan. And we said, look, we have some seed funding. Would you be interested in also coming on board and making something much bigger? And they said, yeah, which is great. You know, they have backed us on several projects, and it's very hard now to get conservation films funded. So
we're
lucky to have the support of people like Terramata and Four Paws. And that then what happened was, as is the way with these projects, is a 3-year journey traveling all over the world, trying to make sense of this story on how we have gone from revering, worshipping, respecting these big cats to locking them in cages, to keeping them as pets or trading them for their body parts.
Watching this film and, you know, looking at a lot of the photojournalist work that you've done, and also all these other amazing photojournalists that you've worked with, you know, Photographers Against Wildlife Crime, obviously with We Animals and Joanne MacArthur on The Hidden Book. And, you know, one of the issues, I think, that for me that always comes up is, you know, how we address this, you know, Western view of, you know, other countries and the way that they treat their wildlife and the way that they deal with it in this. You know, it's so sensitive, I think, especially now, that it was easy to wag the finger, you know, whereas actually what we're also doing in the West towards animals is, you know, in many ways, like, equally bad. And I think what the film, where it treads really carefully, and what I really liked, is when you're interviewing some of these people, you know, they are just, you know, what they're doing, again, for us, keeping big cats in cages, you know, it's just like, oh, it's just appalling. It's really sad. You see how destitute a lot of these animals are. But then you're showing these people just as people, you know, for example, the guy in Pakistan, you know, breeding these lions, he's just portrayed as this normal guy who loves these animals. And, like, you know, for as far as he's concerned, you know, what's wrong with that? And really showing that human aspect was clearly an important part of the film.
Yeah. And that's something that we wanted to do with the documentary, because a lot of conservation films, within the first 30 seconds of watching them, you know what the film is going to be about. And you know that it's going to be about conservation, and it's going to be wagging a finger and saying, you know, look at these people who are doing bad things. Whereas actually, a lot of these issues are much more complicated and nuanced than that. And the guy in Pakistan is a perfect example. And he is keeping big cats which he absolutely adores.
And yeah, I mean, he said, I love them like they're my own children. I pulled that quote out, and you're just thinking, well, yeah, as far as, you know, from his point of view, he's just, you know, it's like him having a couple of house cats.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm a huge fan of Louis Theroux and his style of interviewing, and he is amazing. And I will never be like 1% of what Louis Theroux is on camera, but to be able to extract the information out of people and then to let them make their own mind up. So you don't want to be scorning someone. You don't want to be putting words in people's mouths. You just want them to tell their own story. And sometimes, like with some characters in the film, you know, they really don't come across very well at all.
Yeah, that's, sure.
That's their own doing. Whereas others are much more sympathetic.
It's similarly with Saeed, the trophy hunter. You know, you're there in his house with all his guns, huge stuffed lions in glass cabinets, and, you know, he's there saying, you look, I'm not ashamed for doing this. You know, hunting is something we've been doing for thousands of years, so there's no point in wagging a finger at someone like that. You know, to undo and change and shift that mindset, that's not his generation, you know. That there's years of education with the next generations.
Yeah, and the world is not black and white. There's many shades of gray. And that's what we always want to try and get across in our films. I do think sometimes, actually, some of the stories that I cover, I do think it is quite black and white. And there are some issues that I feel so strongly about, so passionately about, which just involve so much suffering and gratuitous cruelty. That's what I think I find. That's what I find really difficult. But whereas when we're making a film about big cats and something that is much more of a kind of a philosophical journey into the mindset of some of these people, then we want our viewers to watch it. And our viewers are not stupid at all. And they can come up, they can come to their own conclusions about, you know, is it, why does someone find it enjoyable going out and shooting a big cat in the face, which I don't understand. And, you know, yeah, maybe the viewers don't either, but we don't want to be telling them what to feel.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so how, you know, remind me of the release date when this film came out.
So the first, the premiere was last summer, was in the summer.
Yes.
So we've just been doing screenings now and it's doing the festival circuit at the moment.
Great.
And then we just have to see who picks it up.
Yeah.
Said, it's very difficult getting these stories on mainstream media. And it's only, even though there's so much more awareness about environmental issues now, it's only become harder selling these documentaries. And very much the view of the broadcasters is that people have very difficult lives at the moment, and many people are struggling to put food on their plate, or, you know, many places are in a recession. So you want to turn on the TV to be entertained. And it's escapism, and they don't want to be reminded of the problems in the world. And that is something that we've been coming up against for many, many years.
I mean, it was just exactly the conversations that were coming out of Wildscreen last month, or in October, sorry. You know, I met with a German production company that I work with, and, you know, they're there pitching their films, and they're saying, yeah, they want to make more conservation focused films. They do big blue chip stuff. And they're just saying exactly what you just said. It's so hard because, you know, people, they want to come home and see a penguin in a nice sunset. You know, they don't want to see, it doesn't even have to be like really brutal, you know, watching horrors until your eyes are burnt, but just us, you know, some form of education or a conservation, even if it's a positive conservation story, they just don't want to know. And I think, God, in this, it's just really tough, isn't it, to get those stories out to the bigger audiences.
But why is it that there are so many series on Netflix, for example, about serial killers and about murder,
yeah,
and yet they won't touch a story about big cats, because maybe a big cat's being kept in a cage, which maybe actually says a lot about our relationship with animals, and that so many people just cannot bear to see animals suffering. Now, a lot of my family will not look at my work. They refuse to, because it just upsets them too much.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, human beings, we're very good at compartmentalizing, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it's one of our great strengths, but also one of our great weaknesses, how we can, you know, live these dual lives of caring about one animal, but, you know, not another. Or like you say, watching, or, you know, people being brutally murdered by serial killers. Let's have more of that.
Yeah, exactly. And as I always say, like, oh, Jeffrey Dahmer eating people's brains, that's fine. But no, not this poor big cat that's being kept as a pet. Very strange. It's very strange. And, you know, it's a bit worrying as well.
Yeah.
It is something that we've been up against since conservation films have been a thing, which, again, is a shame, because you look at all of these really successful films like The Cove, or Virunga, or Blackfish.
Yeah.
These films were seen all over the world. So if you can get it right, and I think a lot of the time it just means that a broadcaster has to take a chance.
Yes.
But they're not.
That's right. And that was another message that was coming out of Wildscreen, was that they're afraid, because there's the money is not the same as it was 5-6 years ago. You know, that kind of Netflix, you know, bubbles kind of burst. And so the money that's just getting churned into these, you know, certainly into the nature documentaries, are just the same formula. And yeah, I talk about this a lot, and, you know, going back to Attenborough, and I'm not bashing Attenborough at all, because, you know, I love the guy and the world's richer for him. But, you know, do we really need like another blue chip documentary where there's that invented jeopardy, like, oh no, the animal's not going to make it. Oh yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yay, let's all feel great.
Yeah. I know. It's we just have to hope that there's a change, and that eventually they will come and see some sense. The world is burning, so it's about time that they started taking these films a bit more seriously.
And again, it'd be interesting to know about your process and the development of these films, both Eyes of the Orangutan and Dethroned. You know, they do have positive sides to them. You know, it isn't all doom and gloom, you know, stories of coexistence, stories of rewilding, you know, urban wildlife, which of course is, you know, very close to my heart. And that there are solutions, there are ways that we can coexist with animals and coexist with so-called dangerous predators as well. Is that a kind of a conscious effort of yours sort of from early on to put that across in the films that you make?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to have a positive ending. It's like again, now David Attenborough, he incorporates conservation into his films, but it's in the last sort of 1 minute. So it's like, everything is wonderful. Look at all the animals. But, oh, by the way, there are some threats that they're facing. But yeah, I mean, our battle would be even harder than it is now if we had no hope at all. And also people need something to cling on to. Otherwise, you just watch a documentary, and if it finishes on a sour note or on a downer, then people just end up feeling hopeless afterwards. And that's really not what we want. And also there is hope. I like, you know, we always joke about it, that when there's no hope at all and the world is burning, but actually there are people who are dedicating their lives to conservation, to science, to research, to charity, and there is so much more awareness these days, so actually we want them to have their airtime as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's about so much of it, and you know, that again comes across in your films of the people that you work with, you know, giving them a platform that they wouldn't ordinarily otherwise have. Exactly. Just also because, you know, they're busy people and they're doing their job. So it's always
the ones who have the least publicity that are the ones that sort of, that need it the most, because they're off, like you say, they're out there doing their jobs, rescuing animals or working on the front line of conservation. So to be able to give them that voice and that platform is so important.
Yeah, and I always think that, you know, even if, and I'll ask you this question in a minute, but like, you know, how do you quantify the success of a film? How do you measure, you know, what you set out to do and the people that you were aiming to reach? You know, how can you measure that? And it's such a tough thing to do. But I always think, well, look, if that organization that you're championing or platforming gets one extra donation, then as far as I'm concerned, you know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars or whatever it costs to make these things, it's completely worth it.
Yeah. I think it's the same with photography. There's many ways that you can measure success, and they can be small victories or they can be major victories. And a small victory is, like you say, it's a donation. It's someone changing their behavior because of a photo that you've taken or a film that they've watched. Or then the major success can be like we made a documentary about otters and the exotic pet trade, and that was shown at CITES. And from what we've heard, that was really instrumental in helping gain otters additional protection at CITES. So those are the sorts of major victories. Or you go out and you do like a major photographic expose on a terrible zoo, and then, you know, quickly the animals are rescued. That's also a major victory.
Yeah.
But all of these things are what makes the job so rewarding, and it's what makes all the tough days so worth it. I don't want to sound too cheesy here, but it is bloody tough work out there. So when you get these victories, then it helps keep you motivated.
Yeah. And that's a good time to ask you this, because, you know, I asked Joanne MacArthur this on a podcast a few years ago, is like, how do you personally manage, you know, the atrocities that you see and witness? Because I'm sure there's stuff that you've seen that, or perhaps you got photographs of, that you probably don't show. You know, she came on and said, you know, that she had suffered from PTSD as a consequence of all the awful things that she's seen. So, you know, how do you manage and cope with that? And you know, do you have to take yourself or your emotions away from those moments in time? And, you know, she said now, you know, when she's in a slaughterhouse or, you know, a factory farm, it's not really the time to have a hissy fit. You've got a job to do. You know, what's your approach when you're in some of these like really awful situations for animals?
Well, first of all, it's amazing what a smile will do. Mm-hmm. So when you are covering these stories, if you can just go and try and approach them with a positive attitude, then that really helps. But in terms of how you actually process it, it's a combination of things. It's between having a very dark sense of humor, mm-hmm. a hardcore drink and drugs habit, antidepressants,
lots of therapy,
lots of therapy, just getting the feelings and sticking them all in your toes, like burying them as deep as you possibly can, and then hoping that someone will dig them out in years to come. But also when you're on a job, you're so focused, like Joe was saying, and Joe is a huge hero of mine, because you are looking at things through the abstract. You're looking at your composition and your lighting and telling a story, and you're not focusing on brutality and suffering. It's often when you get home that you then start to process your images, not just in terms of like processing them on Lightroom, but processing them in your brain. It can be difficult. I'm not going to lie, but I should say as well that like what we go through as photographers is absolutely nothing in comparison to the subjects that we are documenting. Yeah. So I think it's really a small price to pay for trying to get these stories out there.
Yeah, that's really beautifully put. Can you point to some of your most satisfying sort of success? How do you quantify that? But, you know, projects that you've worked on, and you mentioned the Otter project, you know, other projects that you've worked on where you've felt that was brilliant. You know, that's kind of had the impact that I really wanted.
Mm. Well, again, success personally can come in many forms, whether it's you've won a competition, and that's great for not just for the issue and the subject, but let's be fair, it's great for your ego as well.
Of course.
It makes you feel good. It makes it feel all,
which we can allow ourselves to have, you know, every now and again.
Every now and again, yeah. To be able to give yourself a pat on the back and say, we're making a difference, and we are. I do feel like sometimes it's very hard to quantify this success. There are some stories that I have done where animals have actually gone out and been rescued from terrible zoos. An investigation that I worked on with Four Paws in Cambodia on dog eating. Quickly after that came out, they changed the laws in Cambodia in certain parts, and they made dog eating illegal. Not that they actually adhere to those laws, but to know that people are actually like seeing the work that you're doing and they are taking it seriously is very important, because sometimes it can feel a little bit hopeless. And what we're up against at the moment, in the same way as it's hard to get films out there, it's even more challenging to get your images out there. So sometimes that can feel really difficult, that you can go and work on these really hardcore investigations. And then what do you do with the images, and how do your images get in front of people if people don't want to see them? And you had this great platform in Instagram where your shots could get seen by many millions of people very quickly. And now it's just changed so much. And Instagram is not the platform that it used to be. So this is a constant battle. And we spoke about it briefly at Wildlife Photographer of the Year recently, but what do we do? So how do we get these stories out there? And the answer is, I really don't know. And magazines like National Geographic, they won't touch some of these more hardcore subjects these days. Don't know. What do you think? What do we do?
Yeah, no, it's such a good question. And you know, that again, that's why this month of October is so great, because you know, so many photographers are in London. Selfishly for me, it's brilliant because I'm in London. You know, even if I'm not a winning photographer, I get to like, you know, meet people like you and have these conversations. Obviously I was in Wildscreen, and you know, and also talking to editors. You know, I spoke with, you know, Sabine from Audubon, Alexa Key from National Geographic, also been on this podcast, and it's tough for them too. You know, the budgets are just dwindling. You know, the National Geographic, for example, I just learned this year, went from 12 million subscribers in the kind of 90s and down to 1 million. So, you know, what do they do with that? That shows evidence of how people are getting in information. And of course, we all know people are on YouTube, they're on social media, they're getting it from their phones. It's so spread. So getting those stories out to make an impact. Yeah, I'm kind of repeating what you're saying. It's really, really tough. So yeah, the answer is, I don't really know. I guess you know, certainly competitions, well, like
competitions.
Yeah, competitions are great. But then, you know, like trying to say to a young person, oh yeah, get something in wildlife photography. Yeah, that's brilliant. You'll get great exposure. And you're like, well, that's 100 images. You know, it's just, it's too risky. So, I mean, my personal approach, and I think I've felt this even more since the election in America, is like that feeling of like, oh my God, you know, the populism is just running rife, not just in the States, but all over Europe as well. Like, what do we do? It's kind of a bit depressing. And then the thing is just to focus on like kind of what you can control. And, you know, and my thing is local. And if you focus on local subjects, you know, whether that is close to where you are living or, you know, like what you do, going out and doing these focus stories, then perhaps you can affect some change, certainly inspire some people who are in that area, who are working with that subject, you know, to foster some kind of behavior change, inspire people, also work with NGOs, work with, you know, people and platforming them. Like I'm doing a lot of work with scientists and volunteer groups that are working in the cemetery at the moment. And that's where I feel sometimes you're like, oh my God, is what I'm doing having any impact like whatsoever? And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of life, probably not. It's having very, very little impact. But if you can get those, that kind of warm, fuzzy feeling from supporting an NGO or, you know, platforming someone that doesn't have that kind of access and doing it in a really nice way. Yeah, that's great. But I mean, this is a lot, I've really gone off on a tangent here. How do you get your images out there to magazines? Well, it's a great question.
I was just going back, actually, you were asking about one of my greatest successes and the difference that you can make on a micro level. Right. And it actually made me remember, it was a story that I did about this bear that had been kept at a private zoo, and this bear had lost its mind. It was just a complete gibbering, pacing wreck. It was not there at all. And there was a rescue done on the back of my work. And then I remember a year or two later seeing an image of this bear in like a bathtub splashing around the happiest bear. And it's the only time I think I've ever had like tears running down my face doing this work, and just knowing that bear wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for my work. And I'm not trying to, I don't want to blow smoke up my own ass. But again, it's sometimes you do have to give yourself a pat on the back and a reminder of why you do what you do.
Yeah. And even though the photography, like we mentioned earlier, is a solitary thing, you know, that those images that you took of that bear, that would have been a team effort in the end with, you know, the publications or however you got those images out to the people that were making decisions to rescue that bear. So I always feel like we, of course, play such an important role of the visuals and trying to get that right and to the best of our ability. And then it's up to what we've both said. And so often it's so much more about relationship building and, you know, building those relationships with trust, with people that are like-minded, who also believe in your work and they can see your vision and want to get that out there. That's the team people, part of Stills. Yeah.
Yeah. And the people who aren't doing it, and they're really not the ones in the limelight. Whereas the photographers, we can be the ones who can kind of take some credit because our imagery is seen far and wide. Whereas, as you say, there are so many people involved who are important for getting you in front of these stories. And these are the guys who we want to be highlighting in not just our photography work but also our documentaries.
And so let's move back a bit, because we were talking off air about your life, and it's quite nice doing this podcast towards the end of the year, reflecting on a year where you've released, you know, another big film. Like I said already, how can people watch this film for starters?
They can't. Well, we did a big online screening last week.
Okay.
But now either it's going to be at festivals or we have to wait for a broadcaster to pick it up. But I hope someone will do next.
That's fine. Are there trailers people can watch?
Yes. Yeah,
yes. On your site. Yeah. Okay, cool.
I think on my site, or if you just type Dethroned Terra Mater into YouTube.
Great. Well, look, we'll put the links up on the page. But yeah, clearly a really busy year. You're not done yet. You were telling me you're about to go off to Nepal to photograph another, you know, sort of happy story subject that you love doing.
Yes. Yeah. Just, you know, the largest animal sacrifice on the planet. up to hundreds of thousands of animals which get killed for a religious festival called Gaudiya in Nepal, which happens once every 5 years. Kind of dreading this one.
Yeah.
I don't often, but this one feels like it could be. I mean, it's just fields of animals being decapitated.
Have you been there before?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
I haven't, no. Yeah. So I'm a bit wary about how we will be received and just seeing such brutality on such a large scale.
Yeah.
I am a little bit concerned about it. I'm just knackered as well, personally. It's just been taking on a little bit too much this year.
But on that, I'm interested in when you said how you'll be received. You've got a lot of experience now of going into very tricky situations, potentially very dangerous situations. So how do you reconcile that? For example, you're probably going through all of this now as you're about to leave. What is it tomorrow? Are you filming? Are you doing stills? What happens when you get approached? All of those kind of, the emotions behind it. How do you cope and deal with all of that?
I think a lot of the time it's just gauging the situation. So you know very quickly if it's hostile and if it's not. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, if you can just what a smile will do. So even if you're in a hostile situation, it's amazing if you crack a bad joke, or we get some Nepalese phrases we'll learn beforehand, or even if you're just kind of trying to join in a little bit. Because again, these ideas, it's many hundreds of thousands of people. These aren't monsters. These are people who are doing something that they've done many, many times before and will continue to do in the future. So it's also very interesting to learn about their mindset and to understand more about the festival and the people behind it. But to see animals, thousands of animals just being hacked to pieces in front of you is something that I'm really dreading. So also you have to think a lot about your gear and what kind of gear you're going to use, because you don't want to stand out. If you're there with a massive long lens and a high vis jacket, you probably won't be received that well. I do a bit more filming and photography these days on this, on the iPhone.
On your phone. Incredible.
Yeah, you can shoot raw now. And so if it is really super hostile, then you're just there as a hiker and you just kind of stumbled upon this festival and you're just interested. A lot of the time you just have to use your instincts. And in the nearly 20 years I've been doing this now, I've only ever ended up in really hairy situations a couple of times.
Yeah, that's good. Have you been arrested?
I haven't been arrested. No.
Wow. Yeah. Yes.
You try and take as many precautions as you can. A lot of that is in your pre-production. I cannot underestimate the importance of pre-production and to work with the right people on the ground, the people who really know how to get you out of sticky situations and navigate shoots like this. So having great local fixers is really integral to the work that we're doing. And these are the guys then who are the ones that have to kind of pick up the pieces so we can go in and we shoot and they're left and have to deal with any negative fallout, which fully commend the work that they're doing on the ground, these local activists. Getting good people on board, thinking about your equipment, having the right attitude there and just being very open and non-judgmental. Other things that I would emphasize to anyone who is interested in working on this type of shoot.
That's great. That's really great. And, props to you for going out and doing that. It's,
I'm very lucky. I still love the work. I love the work even more today. I never thought I would be able to stick with anything for as long as I have with this career. I get very itchy feet. I've lived in 10 countries in 12 years and I love novelty, which is, I guess, why photojournalism is great, because you're constantly, it's not like you, Matt. You're great at concentrating on one subject for a long time and just getting phenomenal images and knowing your subject inside out, whereas I kind of hop around a lot and cover many different stories, which is probably why I've still kept the love for it after all these years.
That's amazing. I mean, again, listeners, go on Aaron's website, because the amount of stories are just, it's incredible. And all of these different places. I mean, it makes sense given now that you know told us that you lived in, was it 10 countries in 12 years or the other way around?
Yeah, 10 years, yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Just incredible. I mean, what do you do, you know, what's outside of photography? I mean, I know, you know, you're coming to the tail end of building a house, and you said you've got a few extra gray hairs as a consequence of that. But like, what's your, you know, what do you do outside of that in your downtime and, you know, when you're not thinking about projects, either when you're photographing them or in pre-production, are you kind to yourself, you know?
I try to be. It so consumes your life. This industry, this work just becomes everything. Like every trip I do pretty much is revolved around work, whether it's covering a story or you know, going somewhere to give a talk or awards or whatever it might be. Everything that you do is revolved around your work. And I can't remember the last time like I took a proper holiday or downtime. So all of these things, I was thinking the other day, like when you're a teenager, you do all these, you have all these pastimes, you're good at stuff. You know, I used to play golf. I used to do art. I would love it. And now kind of life takes over. But like you did say, I've been learning, building a house, not physically myself. I can barely hang a photo. But I've been, in the process of building a house on one of the islands in the Philippines. And again, just absolutely between hating it to death, I've absolutely loved it. You just learned so much. It's every bit as stressful and expensive as they say it is. But it's also like with photography, it's very stressful, but it's a really creative endeavor. And you're like, oh, you know, maybe I want to build like an outside mansion. I can do that because like I have land and you can do whatever. Maybe you want to build like a mini driving range on your property. You can do that too. I don't think my wife would be too happy. It's going to be ready hopefully by New Year. And then next year I really plan on, because it's been such a crazy year, I really plan on doing things that are a bit more mindful. You do have to really look after yourself, because if you don't, and I've had it before in the past, I've just had complete meltdowns and breakdowns. And I haven't been able to work for a long time because it's just the toll of the work has been so much. And the last one, luckily, was during COVID, but I just, you know, but then that was when I worked on my book. So it's nice to have these cathartic projects in between the kind of madness. I want to learn about gardening, and it's even a little bit, you know, about DIY.
That's it. It's a bit like, you know, Don McCullen, you know, kind of in his later in his career, you know, went into landscape photography and these beautiful landscapes. Are we going to start seeing, you know, kind of macro shots of beautiful tropical plants in your garden in the coming years?
maybe if they've been, you know, maybe if they're wilting, they're dead or abused in one way or another, they have really super stark lighting, then I might think about it. I don't think I will ever get away with this kind of morbid fascination that's always been within me. I've always been fascinated in death and the darker side of humanity ever since I was a kid. My sister's a forensic psychologist who studies serial killers. I just think maybe it's genetic. I'm not sure. But I'm so fascinated by what we are capable of doing to each other and to the world and to animals. And it's a bit macabre. But I think it's so interesting.
Yeah, no, it really is. And you definitely... that's very evident looking through just not only your journey, but like I said before, the variety of work. I mean, going back, actually, one quick thing we should tell the listeners is I was lucky enough to see a couple of photos of Erin's house, and the view is absolutely stunning. So that in itself, when you get in there and you're on that porch watching the sunset and, you know, whatever, you've got a drink. I don't know if you drink, but you're relaxing, right? You need that kind of downtime from the the macabre, from the sort of dark side that you're, well, you know, that you're fascinated with as well.
Yeah, there's many different corners that I can go into and rock back and forth whilst holding myself and getting over the traumas of this job. No, seriously, I think it's just like places like that and just being outside and in nature, it's so good for you. It's so calming. So I think more of that is in order for next year, and it'll be a business as well. We're going to rent it out, so just learning something new and having alternative forms of revenue as well, because it is difficult in this industry. as you well know, to make a living.
One of the conversations that I had, I can't remember who, with who it was. It was just this, you know, we call it an industry, but it's actually not really an industry. You know, there's no union, you know, there's no real kind of organizations that we, you know, there's ILCP, I guess, but again, it's not everybody can be part of that. That's what I was going to say is, and I'd never really thought about this before, but if you ask any of us, you know, our colleagues, peers in this world, like nobody makes the living in the same way. You know, it's so different how people will earn money from, you know, doing nature photography, conservation, photojournalism. And so it's a kind of a reminder. And again, not to put people off, because there are some brilliant young and emerging photographers out there. But yeah, it must just be so tough to try and, you know, get paid for all the effort and everything that you put in. It's extraordinary. So yeah, you can get a bit of money from somewhere else, another reliable source, then go for it, you know, take on a job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, advice I give to people who are wanting to get into the industry, it's not just important, it's essential now. If you want to get into the world of conservation photography, you absolutely have to have something else to fall back on, whether it's a property that you rent out my assistant she used to work for me. She taught English. And so she would have calls with kind of rich Japanese bankers, and then she would earn, you know, good money per hour. And that then allowed her to continue with her passion of conservation photography. But if you really think that you can go into the industry and you can just start working on these stories and make a living, then it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to put people off, but it's impossible. It's impossible. Even now, after many, many years of sort of top professionals working in the industry, it's only probably the top 0.001% who can make a living doing it.
Yeah.
So no, don't want to put people off, but it will take a long time.
Yeah, definitely. And I say this a lot on the podcast, but Eddie, a previous guest on this podcast, good friend of mine, Eddie Ephraims, who works one-to-one with photographers, he said that the happiest photographers that he works with are the ones that are not professional. And I think that's even now, you know, and I think I naively assumed as I got older, you know, I'm 47 now, that life would just get easier. You know, you get more experience and, you know, you're just being more in demand. And actually, like, that, you know, I'm hustling all the time and I don't mind it, but there are some times where I just think, oh God, it'd be nice just to take on a little teaching job, you know, 2-3 days a week.
some passive income would be nice to then allow you to go out and do these other projects. And especially if your work involves a lot of travel or a lot of being on assignment, then to have that alternative revenue is really important,
I think. Well, look, we're going to slowly wrap things up. I did want to ask you, and it's one of these questions that when people ask me this, it's really annoying. Like when you've just finished a massive book or a massive project, people go, oh, what's next? Yeah. You're like, oh God, give me a bit of breathing room. I've just done this. I'm not sure, but maybe not immediately, but do you have plans, you know, 5-10 years in the future where you'd like to be, what you'd like to be doing, or are you kind of more, you know, reactive to how you pick up work?
5 or 10 years. Well, first of all, we're working on a documentary about a drought in Zimbabwe, which is affecting particularly the elephants. So we've just been in Zimbabwe for a few weeks, and we will have a short film ready quite soon. And the goal is to turn that into a longer documentary. For once, I'm not in front of the camera for this one, which is really nice. Makes a nice change. But that's a really important story, and it's one that we've been trying to tell now for almost 15 years since learning more about it. And it's a place that's very, very dear to my heart, which is Wangi National Park. It's actually a place that Marie and I got married. It's an amazing place that's just every year goes through intense droughts. So that is the immediate goal within maybe next year, is to complete that film, or the next couple of years. And after that, I did say after Dethroned and we had our wrap party and we all went out for dinner, and I said, I'm retiring and I'm not ever doing another project again like that. And I was deadly serious. I was deadly serious then until about sort of 2 weeks later when I was like, come on, get over yourself. And then you're very quickly ready to.
You need to say that though. In that moment, that's totally fine. In that moment, that's how you felt. So that's what you needed to say to, you know.
I was a bit melodramatic. I can't do it anymore. It's like, yes, of course you can. It will be fine. But it does. Each of these projects, you just invest so much. You lose a little bit of your soul with each project that you work on. But yeah, I think it's just the goal is to continue in exactly the same vein. Like I was saying before, I still get as much, if not more, enjoyment from the profession as I did many years ago. And I've been
That's
so
great.
Lucky. I've been so fortunate to be able to travel the world and to meet incredible people and to work on something that I'm passionate about. And there's not that many people that can say that. So I also know I'm not going to use the word blessed because I'll vomit a bit in my mouth, but I do feel very blessed. More of the same, Matt.
More of the same. Aaron, that is brilliant. And, you know, thank you so much for coming on, just talking so openly about all your work. And yeah, it's a real inspiration. You know, one of the many great things about doing this podcast over the years is like, you know, when would I ever spend, you know, a couple of days just, you know, focusing on one photographer and, well, not picking apart, but just going through everything, you know, and again, looking at what you do is so brilliant in juggling both stills, video, and presenting as well. You know, we didn't really talk much about you being a presenter, and it sounds like you don't want to be a presenter anymore anyway.
No, it's terrible. Why does anyone ever want to be on camera? It's terrible. You're tired, you're stressed, and you've got someone sticking a camera in your face asking you how you feel, or you've got to say something in a really eloquent manner. You're like, you just want to hide behind your camera. And that's what I really love is I love taking pictures and I don't love being on camera, but if you have to do it, if it helps lead your audience through the story and then they can come on the journey with you, then of course I will do it again, but I'm just as happy to be behind the camera.
Great, great. Well, yeah, the work really speaks for itself. And, well, I've said this to everyone, you know, we will get you back on. I think, you know, I'm getting close to 50 podcasts now. And, you know, I think, like you said, there's 75 people in this industry. I'm going to just start again from the beginning.
Well, no, thank you. And your podcasts are fantastic. And your ability to delve into these issues and to really get truthful answers out of people is fantastic, which is why I've been begging you to come on for so long. You finally succumbed to the pressure. So thank you.
You're very, very welcome. And we will get this out as far and as wide as possible outside of our community of 75, I'm sure. And hopefully it'll keep the conversation going. And I can't wait to see, you know, what you're up to next. And yeah, hopefully we'll meet each other again as winning photographers in Wildlife Photographer of the Year next year.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. And thank you again for having me.
Thanks so much, Aaron. What a hero in my eyes. Tackling some seriously tricky subjects. And I just love what he said about what he goes through. It's nothing compared to what the animals go through. So much dedication and also just a brilliant guy too. So in spite of what he said about Instagram in that podcast, do give him a follow. He is at Aaron_Jacoski and check out his website, aaronjacoski.com. There are tons of links on his page, on my website, under the podcast section. So go take a look. We are getting towards the end of the year and you probably thought this was my last podcast. Well, think again. I'm going to sneak one more in. So stay tuned for some Christmas/holiday listening as I have Jaime Rojo lined up, who's had an unbelievable year. And if he has some energy left, you can hear all about it on Boxing Day, 26th of December. That's when it will go out. Stay tuned. Thanks again for listening throughout 2024. I'm really looking forward to a new year, new guests, and keeping it going. All the best.